Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Our producer is Jack Brighton, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the economy of Japan. It was not all that long ago, back in the 1980s, when scholars, economists, politicians were talking about Japan as an emerging superpower. Certainly it was at the time an economic superpower, but that many people were actually talking about the possibility that it could not only rival but replace the United States as being the world's leading power, both economic and political. However, in the last few years, the economy of Japan has been quite sluggish and, in fact, has been in recession now for a couple of years, which calls into question some of those predictions about Japan's emergence as a world power. Certainly, people who study Japan and the Japanese economy say that all of the right elements are in place for growth to resume and for Japan to continue to be a very strong country, both politically and economically. But one wonders about these predictions that were made in the 80s and just what sort of place in the world economy Japan will have in the years to come. We'll be talking about some of these issues this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Koji Taira. He is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Illinois, and this is his special area of study. And he has been good enough to come and spend a little time with us this morning on the program. Questions are welcome. All you need to do is dial the number. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, so that if it would be a long-distance call, you may use that number, and we will pay for the call, 800-222-9455. And all we ask of people calling is that they're brief, so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible. Anyone is welcome to call, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you are welcome, David.
Maybe the place to start would be to just reflect a little bit on some of the things that people were saying back, and we're not talking about going back very many years, back in the 80s, about the both the economic and political power of Japan. And people were indeed talking about the possibility that Japan not only would be an economic rival, but would be a political rival to the United States. And it now, as we look back, we see that those kinds of predictions missed the mark or went far of the mark. But at the time, that was sort of the conventional wisdom. Were there, in fact, though, people at that time who were urging some caution and saying, well, perhaps we ought to be a little bit careful about that?
No. In fact, everybody was caught off guard in this respect. One of the famous high-profile professors at Harvard, Professor Ezra Vogel, for example, was throughout the 80s warning the public that America's hegemony would give way to Japan's Pax Americana diminishing and Pax Nipponica rising. That was the tone of debate in those days. I am slightly guilty of similar mistakes in perception because I also joined the ongoing debate of those days, only modifying Ezra Vogel's hawkish view in a slightly moderate manner. Even so, I too thought that Japan's economic might translate into political influence and military power. All bets are off now. We were all wrong. And even after a few years into the 90s, no one was really seriously revising his or her view of Japan's capability. We are frantically trying to revise all the models and thoughts about the Japanese economy now.
This is a question I realize that is complex, but let's begin talking about it. Why is it that the Japanese economy has done so poorly in the last, say, 8 years?
Oh, that is part of the difficulty of interpretation. Since we misread all the signs in the 80s, by definition, apparently we didn't see the signs of the decline to come in the 90s. Everybody has some simplistic formula nowadays to answer why Japan has been declining in the 90s. The famous word is the bubble of the 1980s. It connotes the rapid rises in all kinds of asset prices, stock prices, real estate prices, and so on. And the whole economy in terms of prices bubbled up, and that eventually burst. And that is the number one culprit everybody mentions as the beginning of the decline of Japan in the 90s. But of course, that's only the beginning. The real story is probably summed up by the American demand that Japan do something about structural impediments to international trade. That happened during the Bush administration. SII, Structural Impediments Initiative, was taken by the U.S. government against Japan. That, in a sense, created some serious rethinking about the whole array of economic, monetary, and trade policies in Japan, and some serious restructuring suggestions came up from all quarters of the Japanese economy. And so when the bubble burst, Japan was caught in a dilemma of short-term recovery policy and long-term structural policy. Before the matter became serious, the Japanese government wanted to do the structural part of the policy first, almost neglecting the short-term recovery policy. And obviously, long-term policy required long-term, long time. And in the meantime, short-run downward slide proceeded unaided, unhindered. So by the middle of the 50s, we were in trouble as a consequence of the cumulative effects of short-run mistakes or neglect. So that's where we are now.
Yeah. Let me just ask you about one thing, that is the notion of structural impediments. Uh-huh. This was something that was a point of contention between the United States and Japan. The Japanese would always say, well, no, there are no structural impediments. And Americans and perhaps Europeans who wanted to do business in Japan said, oh, well, certainly there are. And I suppose there were economists, academics, writers who weighed in on one side or another and said, no, well, really, they said either the problem is deliberate impediments that the Japanese have erected, or it's the fact that it's a cultural issue and that Europeans and Americans are having a difficult time in Japan because they simply didn't understand the Japanese culture and the Japanese market. And if they made some adjustments to the way they did business, then they would be more successful. So those two ideas, those people sort of slugged it out back and forth over a number of years. And I guess I was never quite certain who was right. Were there indeed structural impediments, deliberate barriers put up by Japan to outsiders who wanted to get into that economy?
In hindsight, yes, to that question. There were structural impediments. And one glaring outcome of the structural impediments was a sharp and increasing discrepancy between external prices and internal prices. The Japanese goods and services domestically produced and consumed, when evaluated by prices, U.S. prices, for example, would amount to almost twice as high as the U.S. Price level compared with the exchange rate adjusted values. And that is to say the Japanese had some sort of structural forces which would encourage exports at rather low prices and keep imports out so that the domestic markets were protected at higher prices. And the price comparisons immediately suggested there was something wrong in the basic structure. And from that point of view, the inference would have it that there were impediments to the free flow of goods and services and money inside and outside Japan, yes. And another interesting aspect of this problem is that when the U.S. government argued that by eliminating the impediments and opening Japan to more foreign trade, the Japanese consumers would benefit from lower prices, it was not the Japanese government, but the Japanese consuming public who supported the American position. And so a saying arose in those days at the end of the 80s that the U.S. government was the best protector of the Japanese consumers. That was quite amazing indeed. So the U.S. government had 120 million Japanese consumers on its side when it was negotiating SII with the Japanese government. No government would have such luck.
Let me reintroduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Koji Taira. He is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the Japanese economy, what has happened with it over the last few years, and what's likely to happen here in the near and the long term. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. I was very struck by a story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that to me seemed to be very significant in indicating a change and illustrating how difficult times were in Japan, and that is it's about very high levels of unemployment and about the fact that this idea that we had been introduced to back in the 80s and perhaps before, that there was something called lifetime employment in Japan. Whether that was ever true, it's certainly not true anymore. that unemployment in Japan is now at the highest level since the government started keeping statistics in 1949, and that that people are Japanese people are having to really face up to the idea that even if some of them had employment security before, that they don't anymore. I know just you've been fairly recently, we're in Japan for a couple of months. How do people feel these days about their future?
They feel very badly indeed. Something interesting happened when I was in Japan these past few months. Around Christmas time last year, only a month and something ago, there was email from the Wall Street Journal in my machine asking me exactly that question. What does it mean that the Japanese unemployment rate now converged on the American unemployment rate at 4.4% of the labor force? The figure was from the month of November. And the graph appearing on the Wall Street Journal, the front page, around that time showed that the Japanese unemployment rates were trending upward, and American unemployment rates, while fluctuating, trending downward, and the twain met exactly at 4.4% in November, and that was the big news in Japan. Mm-hmm. All the while, they were saying that in a country of lifetime employment, unemployment could never reach the American level. America is known in Japan as a callous hire and fire economy where employment was at will and so on. So the Japanese probably were the first to be surprised at this converging phenomenon of unemployment rates. I should emphasize is that Japan has never had lifetime employment as a nationwide institution. It was only an arrangement for convenience among a small number of well-run large companies. I was, from the very beginning of this controversy, on the side of the market forces as the predominant factor in the labor market, arguing against lifetime employment. And so I personally don't have any sympathy for the view that there was any sort of puzzle between the commonly believed lifetime employment and Japanese unemployment. Actually, I did a sort of pioneering estimate of Japan's true unemployment rate according to some rigorous application of the American labor force concept. According to my figures, the rule of thumb that comes out of my study is you should double the officially announced unemployment rate to get the Japanese equivalent of U.S. type of unemployment. And so if you double 4.4, you actually get a depression level of unemployment rate, even by the American concept. So that's the sort of idea. So there is absolutely no puzzle, no mystery in Japan's real unemployment moving up or down according to the market forces. And the markets are lousy now, and they should have unemployment.
Yeah. Japan has had 9 different prime ministers in the last 10 years.
Ah, yes,
is that
indeed.
Correct?
Since 1993.
I guess that most of those would be LDP.
Yes.
So we're talking about the same party generally, the same group, the same kind of people running the country, despite the fact that we're having all these different people as prime minister. But that would also suggest, though, some political instability. Is there some relationship between that change, the fact that we've had so many people in that leadership position, and the economy of the last 10 years?
That's a difficult question for economists. The relationship between nature of politics and economic performance is probably a subject best left for political scientists. I do not think Japan's top-level political instability is really something that deserves to be called instability. They are taking turns in filling the top positions. And so the same people come back to fill different posts, and it's a kind of merry-go-round. The Japanese ministerial posts are allocated according to the dynamics of political groups. And so at most, a minister doesn't stay a minister stays in his portfolio, in his position, only a year, at most 2 years, during which he cannot affect the policy of his ministry. And so in Japan, the stabilizing force is the bureaucracy. The state bureaucrats are permanent hands, so to speak, and they are the ones who do everything that we call government. They draft laws, and members of the parliament rubber stamp bureaucratically prepare the bills, and ministers of state duly enforce such legislations, and so on. So long as the bureaucracy worked, Japan was fine, regardless of the political instability. But there was the catch. Bureaucracy itself eventually became corrupt. And that is probably the root cause of the profound malaise we now have in Japan.
Well, it certainly is the case that there has been, if not just for the post-war period, even going further back, very strong central government in Japan, making many decisions in many areas of life for people all over the country. And I suppose if one has a kind of hidebound, resistant change bureaucracy, and they have a way of operating that works during one period, that apparently worked well during the period of growth in the 50s and 60s, but then when perhaps things started to change and a different orientation was required, the bureaucracy was not inclined to change the way that it was thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that observation is sound, I think. Even so, modern bureaucracy, by that I mean bureaucracy after the last war, has been working reasonably well because during the first 20 to 30 years, younger bureaucrats, many of them U.S. educated, had new ideas to use in Japan. But they became older, and some many of them retired, and inbred bureaucrats became apparently less able in coming up with new ideas, handling problems, and so on. And so one would say over time, the overall capability of bureaucrats too has declined, and they succumbed to corrupt practices due to the crony relationship with the business community and so on. Yes.
Our guest this morning in this hour of focus is Koji Taira. He is Professor Emeritus of Economics at University of Illinois. We're talking about the Japanese economy. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I think that some people have observed that Japan has, within the last 130 years or so, gone through two very revolutionary periods of change, the first being the Meiji Restoration that brought an end to feudalism in Japan, and the other being the changes that came about after World War II, with the American occupation. And I think some people also feel that Japan may be on the brink of another period of revolutionary transformation that might be as significant as those other two. Do you think that is the case?
Obviously, a revolution is hard to see when it is in process.
Then looking back, yeah.
Revolution always stands out when historical research is done on something long past. In fact, as an economist who believes in slow but steady groundswell of market forces, nothing appears radically different to me. Actually, the so-called Meiji Restoration was no revolution as such, as it is called restoration. They wanted to rewind the clock to make their ancient practices of government work in reality. It was almost a retroactive reaffirmation of their own identity. But one would say the American occupation led by General Douglas MacArthur probably did most radical work on Japanese governmental restructuring. That one could say deserves the name of a revolution. Yes, indeed. Japan had a huge dividend from the MacArthur reforms, the Japanese, in the last several decades, added some incremental improvements on the McCarthy regime, which altogether now add up to some sort of obstacles to further changes. But these further changes needed to make basically what appears to be the MacArthur revolution would not be as radical as what MacArthur actually did back in 1945 to 1952, mm-hmm. I should think. So I don't see any revolution. Slow but a little quickened change would be all we will see in Japan.
In terms of structural reform, that's something that I read a lot, that phrase I read a lot in articles about what's happening now with the Japanese economy, mm-hmm. that's certainly people do argue that some important change needs to be made. Maybe sometime in the future we would look back on it and said it was very important, if not revolutionary, if it happens. But mm-hmm. let me ask the question, what sort of changes do you think would be important to make, structural changes in the Japanese economy?
One bundle of changes that everybody mentions comes under the rubric of deregulation. Deregulation has several ramifications. Above all, deregulation implies decentralization of governing practices. The Japanese state is excessively concentrated in the center and at the top. In order to make the unitary, unified, concentrated state work, this central government bureaucracy has enormous powers to regulate the behavior of all local governments in minute detail. Mm-hmm. One famous story is that a small town hundreds of miles away from Tokyo can't even change the position of the bus stop without the approval of the Ministry of Transportation in Tokyo. And the hand of the central government reaches out so far and in so much detail that really has to be changed. This part of structural reform comes under governmental reform and called division of power between central and local governments. This is going on rather nicely, it seems. And of course, the deregulation is more popular on economic matters. International trade, government's investment activity, and private business sectors, dual structure, so-called dual, because there appears to be a big gulf, a big gap in productivity and other indicators between large favored enterprises and small and middling firms and so on. These are the structural changes people are talking about. Political reform, economic reform, especially foreign trade practices.
I think it's also true, or do correct me if I'm wrong about this, is that not only have perhaps local governments been hampered by bureaucrats in the central government telling them what to do, but also local governments have been dependent on money handed out by the central government. So, and I think some people have also said that's something that needs to change. But if that does, is that going to be a problem for local government that had become dependent upon this money that was coming in from the center?
This will be a problem, but the problem is only one of adjustment and practice. The local government certainly have been out of practice in exercising their taxing power, programming and policy making exercises. There will be some time before the local politicians and local officials catch up with what they should legitimately be doing. But in the over the medium term, I think adjustment will be made. The biggest conceptual problem is this notion of taxing power. how should it be shared between the central government and the local government. And there, the vested interests of the existing state bureaucracy works against sharing larger taxing power with the local government. If that persists, then the state, the central government, still would be taking away large chunks of taxes from residents of the local areas and pretend to share the proceeds by paternalistic redistribution. And to that kind of central government paternalism, people obviously have to submit themselves. So far, we don't seem to see a large amount of revolt against that sort of demeaning practice.
We have a caller to talk with, someone on the campus. Others are welcome to call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, speaking with Koji Taira. He is a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Illinois, talking about the Japanese economy. That's his special area of interest and expertise. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller on our line number two. Hello.
Hi. Thank you. I was wondering if Professor Taira could talk about the effect that the problems of the Japanese economy are having on the countries in the rest of Asia, and if he would be willing later on to predict what effect this might have later on the U.S. itself. I'll just hang up and listen.
All right. Excellent question.
The first major effect Japan's stagnation has on Asia is a great decrease in Japan's ability to import from Asia. That surely complicates the foreign exchange position of Asian countries, and eventually it adversely affects Asia's ability to recover from the economic problems Asia now has. Probably there is some deeper problem there. Until the U.S. Finally succeeded in driving this point home with the Japanese never thought that as the largest economy in Asia, they had a special responsibility to positively and aggressively help Asian countries to overcome their problems. Somehow the insular view of the world that most Japanese share has prevented them from taking their international role seriously. That's probably the fundamental question. As for the United States, the Japanese obviously think the U.S. is a wonderful cash cow, milking it to remedy Japan's domestic economic problems. And as you have noticed, Japanese exports to the United States have been doing very well and getting better all the time. and that is the one bright spot in the otherwise stagnating Japanese economy. Beyond that, what sort of cooperation should Japan have with the United States? I don't think the Japanese are quite clear about that. When something wrong happens in Japan, it appears the Japanese have acquired the habit over time to turn to the U.S. for help to solve their problems. And so the best help the U.S. Can give to Japan is keep importing Japanese goods.
Mm. You know, last year we were talking a lot and reading a lot about problems in the economies of East and Southeast Asia. There also was a lot of concern at one point about Japan and its the health of its financial sector. Were in fact the difficulties that the Japanese were having related to the problems in the economies of Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, or was it the case that these things just were happened to be happening at the same time, and there was not causal relationship between the big crash in the financial sector in Japan and economic difficulties, currency difficulties, and some of these other countries, South Korea, another one.
The bigger part of financial trouble in Japan is internal. As a consequence of the bubble bursting, companies and the banks got stuck with huge bad debts. Mm. Of course, as a consequence of the Asian crash, the same companies and the banks also had the problem of bad loans with the Asian countries. But proportionately, I would say the Asian bad debts would be one-fifth of the total bad debt problem the Japanese banks and the companies have. The Japanese banks and the companies have been very clever, as encouraged by the government, to conceal what problems and how much of it they have so far. And so every time we talk about the bad debts, the amount goes up and up. Mm-hmm. And probably we are now speaking of bad debt problem in the order close to $1 trillion, out of which probably $200 billion might originate in the Asian default. Mm. So that's how big it is. Mm. And Japan's GDP is about $5 trillion, and so the bad debt accounts for a good chunk.
That's a big chunk.
Yes.
And I think the criticism has been made that these kinds of problems with the financial sector in Japan, they're not recent. They've been there, and that perhaps that people in government in Japan chose not to see them, turned away, and should have really taken the proverbial bull by the horns years ago, mm-hmm. but chose not to.
That's right. Exactly. Not only did they choose not to, but positively conspired to conceal. The accounting practices and rather leaky regulatory laws apparently permit poor accounting practices and poor supervision of financial institutions to a large extent. And when something awful turns up, it usually is too late to cope with it.
Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Can you tell me how does Japan view its holdings in U.S. bonds for the long term? Is it something that they look at as dispensable? I think you get my question.
During the 80s, the Japanese bought up a lot of U.S. bonds. Anytime there was auction of treasury bills and bonds, I had a figure, one-third of new issues going to Japanese investors. I, at the moment, don't have the round overall figures, but if one-third persisted, then I would say Japan has that much of U.S. debt. That gave Japan considerable bargaining power during the 80s, but after that, in the course of the 90s, it is possible they have been divesting gradually their U.S. holdings. Certainly, private banks and businesses have been retreating from the United States by selling off their previous investments, and bondholders might be doing the same. Now the table is turned around, and the Japanese politicians are saying that it is now the turn for the U.S. to help Japan by buying up the huge Japanese government bonds. Probably the score will be evened as the matter proceeds.
And if there's time, I was wondering, I heard someone give the opinion that that there's a lot of pent-up industry or economy being held back by the global economy is being held back by, you know, Japan's restrictive domestic market, restricting access to its domestic markets. And I was just wondering if you believe that, if you think that the minute Japan liberalizes its domestic markets, the global economy is going to get a great boost. And thank you.
All right.
Yes, to some extent that is true. The Japanese consumers, who consume 60% of Japan's GDP, nowadays seem to have lost confidence entirely in Japanese economy and in the world economy, and they are not buying anything. Until buoyant consumer confidence returns, no amount of structural reforms may help Japan or the world economy. But in principle, since the Japanese economy is so huge, 60% of the U.S. Economy, Japan certainly should have the idea of helping the world or contributing to the world economy by active imports. They haven't come to that point yet.
We will have to stop there because we are at the end of our time. We want to say to you, Professor Tara, thank you very much.
Oh, you are quite welcome. I have enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Our guest, Koji Taira, he is an emeritus professor of economics at the University of Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, Illinois. The Little Theater presents I Do, I Do as their special Valentine's production, February 10th through the 14th. Tickets are available by calling toll-free 1-888-261-9675. And all this week, you can show your support of WILO by shopping at Pages for All Ages bookstore in their new location at the corner of Route 45 South and Curtis Road in Savoy. Through Sunday, 20% of your purchases will benefit WILL Radio and TV. Just mention to the cashier you would like your purchase to be credited to WILL, and we thank Pages for All Ages for their continued support of public radio. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.